Les colloques du Collège de France.
All right. Thank you, Yvonne. It's really a great honor to be here and to celebrate your chair. It's always wonderful to come to Paris. Actually, I think the Jacques-Louis Lyon lecture, like you said, 3 years ago, Lesson, were really a highlight, but it's been wonderful and it's been really great to hear all the talks this week. So thank you, everybody, for sticking through to the end. And thank you also for arranging some Texas temperatures, although we need to get Texas air conditioning in here. Always the trips to Paris have a theme. So my daughter's here with me. You've seen her. Paris is her favorite city. She gets to choose to come with me occasionally, and she always chooses Paris. We always have a theme, and this year the theme is sugar. So we have been doing a tour of macarons, ice creams, and other fancy desserts, and we have more to come. All right, so you saw the title of the talk, Multifidelity POD, and I think in some ways the topic of this talk goes in quite a different direction to a lot of what we've heard this week, but it's also quite well aligned with a number of the talks. So I am becoming increasingly concerned with the cost of training, and I'm becoming increasingly concerned that many people in our community are focusing on methods where the cost of generating the training data, the snapshots, is just prohibitive for real-world applications. And some of this, you know, comes from my role as an engineer, where while we are thinking about new methods, we really are tightly tied to the applications. So I'm going to focus today on POD, proper orthogonal decomposition, in part because I am firmly convinced that the more classical reduction methods still have an incredibly important role to play. While we've seen some really impressive results this week with nonlinear approximations, there is a huge number of problems in the real world where the linear reduction methods still have a role to play. And what's more, if you reflect on many of the talks that we've seen, even if people are using nonlinear autoencoders, other machine learning approaches, you almost always see the SVD and buried in there somewhere. And yesterday was a really good example of that with Andrea's very nice talk, where in almost every one of his beautiful diagrams, you saw that wedge that was the POD giving you the dimensionality reduction on which everything else was built. So I'm going to talk today about POD, of course, PCA, SVD. Everything I'll say is applicable, whatever your particular view of it is. The pictures that you see up here, this is a picture, actually, I think we saw this in Benjamin's talk yesterday as well. This is Yonut Farkas's recent work, where we've been working with the Air Force Research Laboratory to do reduced order models for rotating detonation rocket engines. And this is a great example where the computational cost of generating training snapshots is a real barrier. Yonut was able to get some pretty remarkable results, I think surprisingly good, using our operator inference approach, where we can go from a CFD code here with 76 million degrees of freedom and with just 24 modes. Of course, we don't get all the details, but we do a surprisingly good job of getting the what you might call the low order response of this very complex flow. And one of the reasons you might ask is why only R equal 24? What would happen if you could go to higher dimension? That was actually the highest dimension that we could get to because we were limited by the number of snapshots that we had available. In this example, we had 375 snapshots on which to train. Those 375 snapshots were the result of months of computation on high-performance computing. And you say, why only 375? Even if you can run for several months to do an unsteady CFD simulation like this, the CFD solver that they have takes a time step of a nanosecond, and they were saving 1 in 10,000 snapshots. So it was actually 500 that we got in the end. We kept some out for testing, but the 500 snapshots was all they could afford to save, because, by the way, the 76 million degrees of freedom was also downsampled spatially. So this is something we have to really think about as a community. There's the runtime and the energy consumptions of generating the snapshots in the first place, then there's the question as to if you can do those runs, can you really store databases of millions of snapshots when you go to industrial grade problems? And the answer is maybe sometimes, but again, I think there are many problems where we can't. So this is the challenge that we're going to try to take on, which is how do we do more with less? The motivation is going to come from some of my group's previous work on multifidelity uncertainty quantification methods, and I'll go through that theory in a second. Quite recently, just last year, Nicole Aritz worked with the multifidelity Monte Carlo method, which you'll see was earlier work done by one of my PhD students, Leo Ng, and then by Benjamin when he was a postdoc in my group. And in the work that Nicole did, we collaborated with a glaciologist to apply the multifidelity Monte Carlo methods to characterizing uncertainty in ice sheet simulations. So this is another example. These ice sheet simulations are fascinating. The results that you see here, this is for continental Greenland, and it's not, I'm being recorded, so let's not say anything about why we might be studying Greenland. The uncertainty is, again, as we all know around climate modeling, uncertainty is pervasive, showing there just a couple of the uncertain parameters, the geothermal heat flux and the basal friction field. So that's the boundary condition at the base where the ice sheet is sliding on the rock. So these are infinite dimensional parameter fields, which when discretized, take on the dimension of the high fidelity mesh. And it's absolutely critical to quantify these uncertainties because either you can't measure them, you don't know them, or in the case of the geothermal heat flux, there's no agreement in the community as to what the right model is. And the consequence of these uncertainties is that there's then a large amount of uncertainty in the quantities of interest, which might be, in this example, sea level rise. But again, these are simulations where the climate scientists like to run the simulations out to the year 2100. Each one of these simulations is taking days, and now you're imagining sampling over these uncertain parameters where you want to do hundreds or thousands of simulations that each take days on a supercomputer. It's just completely intractable to really generate that much data. So what are we going to do? We're going to exploit, as I said, the multifidelity UQ ideas. And the climate modeling one is a really nice one. This is also drawn out in Nicole's 2025 paper because it's one where there are all kinds of approximate models that are in wide use in the community. You have the highest fidelity simulation of the ice dynamics and the high fidelity physics model, which I'll show later on. But then there are all these simplified physics models that introduce approximations in different ways and that run much, much faster. And then, of course, there are also coarser meshes and many other ways to accelerate these high-fidelity solvers before you even get to a reduced order model. So what we're going to be doing is making use of those approximate but cheaper models in the computation of the POD basis. Okay, so POD 101, we've seen it in many shapes and forms throughout the week. Here's just a quick recap. Most of the talk is going to be continuous, but I much prefer to think of things in linear algebra when we're in the semi-discrete form. So here just to start is snapshots U that have been discretized in space. So the dimension of our spatial discretization is going to be little n. We have m snapshots, u1 through um. They could be selected times if we're doing a time-dependent simulation. They could be selected parameter values if it's a parametric problem. And if it's both, you're going to need to sample in both parameter and time. What do you do with POD? You form the snapshot matrix where you stack all the snapshots up. You might subtract off the mean. We're going to sort of leave that aside for today because it doesn't really matter too much. That snapshot matrix is going to be n by m, and then the POD basis is nothing but the left singular vectors of that snapshot matrix, where the singular values we know have this non-decreasing order, and whoops, we have a pointer. Yep, we have a pointer. And we'll have at most m non-zero singular values if we started off with m snapshots. And of course, we all know well that this is the optimal projection in a least squares sense in the terms of reconstructing that snapshot information. All right, so just again to remind you, there are different ways that we could think about computing the POD basis. So I think the vast majority of people think of them as the left singular vectors of the snapshot matrix. I think we have MATLAB, and we should give a little tribute to Cleve Moeller, who passed away, I think, last week or the week before, for bringing us MATLAB and giving us SVD of U or SVD of X at our fingertips. So that's a common computational approach. But of course, the POD basis vectors are also the eigenvectors of UU transpose, which would be an N by N big matrix. And they are also linear combinations of the snapshots and could be computed by the original method of snapshots that goes back to the Cyrovich 1981 paper, where you would compute U transpose U. So this would be an M by M matrix. Take the eigenvectors of this small matrix, and those eigenvectors give you the linear combinations to reconstruct the POD basis vectors. So there's a variety of paths numerically to getting to these POD basis vectors. Since it's simpler to see, I'm going to be working with this middle one today and what I show you, even though computationally, probably that is the one that you would not do. But you'll see how the theory comes out. Okay, so this is the setting that we're going to have in the talk. We're not going to have any time-dependent problems. We are going to have a forward model that is denoted here by F0. This is our high-fidelity model, and it's going to be mapping a parameter or a set of parameters, theta, to a state that I'm going to denote by U0. And again, here's the POD statement written out as a minimization. And again, this is just a restatement here. This pi sub v is the projector based on the basis v. And we know that the POD basis is going to minimize that projection error, that projected error. So we're going to think about this theta, and this now touches a little bit on the setting that Katrin showed this morning, where she was in the randomized POD setting. So we're going to think about these parameters theta as being uncertain with a distribution that I'm going to call mu. And when we are computing our POD snapshots in the setting, we're going to be drawing MIID samples from that distribution mu. So those are the samples theta 1, theta 2, and theta m. So here are our snapshots. If the cost of one high fidelity simulation is C naught, so everything with a naught on it is related to the high fidelity model, then the total computational cost of computing these snapshots is going to be m, the number of snapshots, times the computational cost. Here's the POD cost function. We'll call it curly JMC. So this is just what's sitting inside the minimization statement here. And if we frame this problem in this way, with theta being uncertain and the snapshot generation being a sampling of the uncertain set of parameters, then this is nothing but the Monte Carlo approximation of actually the expectation of this projection error over the parameter space theta, which again is distributed according to mu. And I think this is very much aligned with what we saw earlier this morning. Okay, so if we take this view, and by the way, I should mention, I'm not going to, we don't have any theory for it yet, but this Monte Carlo view of POD also has a really nice connection to the control theoretic view of POD in the time domain, where the POD basis vectors are the eigenvectors of the controllability Gramian, and the controllability Gramian is also an integral over time. So at some level, POD, when you do the method of snapshots, what you're really doing is quadrature. Right? You're approximating an integral. Here the integral is the expectation over the parameter theta. In the time domain POD, it's the Gramian, which is the integral over time. So really all we're saying here is let's think of POD as a quadrature, in this case with Monte Carlo. So when we approach POD from this perspective, we can draw on the Monte Carlo theory. Here's our Monte Carlo we're approximating, and this curly J now is going to be the truth cost function, if we could compute this expectation exactly. So we know that the mean squared error of our Monte Carlo estimator, because it's an unbiased estimator, is going to be 1 over m times the variance of this projection error, And again, Katrin kind of referred to this earlier this morning in a slightly different setting. Here's where we see the Monte Carlo 1 over M convergence rate. This is what comes to bite you with slow convergence in the number of samples. And Katrin noted this morning that this is dimension independent. You don't see the dimension of the parameter theta showing up in these Monte Carlo rates. But you want to be, I think you want to be just a little bit careful because this variance term here, this constant, really embodies how complicated the problem is. And if you have a very high dimensional parameter space with complex dynamics, I think you're going to see sort of an effect there in this variance term. Okay, so for many problems, we can get away with few samples, but for many problems, we're going to be in some trouble with this 1 over M. Okay, so let's switch gears away from POD for a second and talk about variance reduction via control variates. So control variates is an old, well-known statistical technique for reducing variance in estimators. Control variates is the method on which we built the multifidelity Monte Carlo method. It's also the theory on which the multi-level Monte Carlo method is built, and I'll say a little bit about the differences in just a second. So multifidelity Monte Carlo, the setup is this. So we still have this high fidelity model, this F0, and here let's think about it mapping an uncertain parameter or set of parameters theta to a scalar output y. In addition, and what we're trying to do is estimate the expectation of y, so with y just being a scalar in this case. And what we also have available to us are these L other models, F1, F2, up to FL, that also map theta to y, but are approximate and much, much cheaper to run. So what do we do in multifidelity Monte Carlo? We say, first of all, each one of these models has a cost associated with it. Model L is cost CL. We are going to run each model ML times. So we're going to run the high fidelity, most expensive model M0, M0 times, the next one M1 times, and so on. And we're ordering the models so that we're running the bottom one, the L1. We're taking the most samples from that model. And then we're going to form this multifidelity Monte Carlo estimator of the expected value of y. So what is this estimate that we're calling here S hat? There's this term here, y bar 0 m naught. This notation means this is the mean, the empirical mean, that is estimated using m naught samples of model 0. So this would be, if just straightforward Monte Carlo, if you took m0, you can tell I've been in New Zealand for the last couple of weeks because I keep calling it naught. That's what the British call it. What do you call it in France? Zero? Zero, okay. Naught is zero. Zero is naught. M0, M0 sounds better. So if we were to take M0 samples of the high fidelity model, this would be the standard Monte Carlo estimator. But what you see is that we add this term, and what is this term? This term is now a sum over our other models, over our other levels. It is a control variate coefficient, an alpha L, times the difference of two means. And what are the two means here? This is the mean estimated using ML samples of model L, and this is the mean estimated using L minus 1 samples of model L. And so what you're doing here is adding and subtracting a mean that was estimated in different ways. So again, this builds on classical control variate theory. Why would you do this? You do this because when you now write out the mean squared error of this now multi-fidelity estimator, what you see is that the variance, here's the original Monte Carlo variance term that we had before, the sigma naught squared divided by now M0. But now here's this other term that is coming from the control variate terms. And if you kind of study this term and you move things around a little bit, what you recognize, what you see showing up here are these rho L's. These are the correlation coefficients that measure how correlated is model L with the high fidelity model, model zero. And what you see is that if you have models that are cheap to evaluate, but are highly correlated with your truth model, you can shift computational costs onto those cheap models, and in doing so, get an estimator that is unbiased. You added and subtracted on average zero. These two cancel out on average, but that reduces the mean square error. So you are not changing the convergence rate of the Monte Carlo estimator. You're still stuck with 1 over m, but what you can do is change that constant. That's where the variance reduction comes in. Let's see, what else do I want to say here? So again, this is old work. My student Leo Ng worked on this many years ago, and then Benjamin developed some theory that I'll show in a second. In a CISC paper together with Max Gunsberger. Just a quick mention, some of you may be familiar with the multi-level Monte Carlo methods, which are very closely related. There's a little bit of difference with the multi-fidelity in the way that we share samples across the levels. And actually, we're working together with Mike Giles on a paper that shows some of those differences. So the way the samples are shared across the levels is a little bit different, which induces a little bit of a different structure in the variance reduction of the mean squared error. And also, with multi-level Monte Carlo, started off really thinking about grid hierarchies using theoretical results to estimate what plays the role of the correlation coefficients that we have, these rho Ls, and also the relative computational costs between the levels. With the multi-fidelity method, we always thought more broadly about the kinds of models that could go into the pot to be used, and so we actually use pilot samples to get estimates of these coefficients if you don't have them available from theory. Okay, but let's keep going a little bit with the multi-fidelity Monte Carlo theory with one more slide. So first of all, the cost, the total cost is going to be the cost of each level times the number of samples you draw from that level. And now we can pose, and this is the work that Benjamin, a really nice formulation that Benjamin came up with, we can now ask the question, given a total computational budget P, how might I optimally distribute that computational budget across all of these L plus one models so that I minimize the variance of the estimator? By the way, if you prefer, you could turn the problem around and say, if I want to get a particular quality of estimator, I want to put a limit on the variance of the estimator, what's the minimum computational budget I could achieve? So you could phrase it that way, but what's shown here is, given a computational budget, how do you minimize the variance? And when you write it out and have these constraints, this is how we're ordering the models, here's the constraint on the budget, it actually turns out that this optimization problem has an analytic solution. It turns out that the optimal control variate coefficients are these correlation coefficients times here the ratio of the standard deviation of the truth model compared to model L. And then there are these expressions for the optimal sample sizes. And what's really interesting, what shows up here in these ratios that I'm calling here A to L, you see that it's not just how level L relates to the truth model, it's also how model L relates to the other low fidelity models that you have in the pot. So it really is a strategy that kind of looks at all the levels that you have available, all the different models that you have available, and thinks about how you can distribute the computational budget so that you minimize the variance of the estimator. Okay, so let's come back to POD. And with the framing of POD in the Monte Carlo setting, I think maybe it's fairly obvious how one could think about putting these two ideas together. So, again, in case it's not obvious, let me say it again. The idea here is to use control variance to get variance reduction, which means either you get the same quality estimator of this POD cost function for lower cost, or for a given budget that you have, you can achieve a better estimator of this POD cost function. And when we get to the numerical results, you'll see how that plays out into a better basis for dimension reduction, model reduction, whatever you're going to do with it. So again, here's our truth cost function. What we're after is an expectation of the true cost function that we could call curly J. So what we're looking for is now a multi-fidelity estimate of that. We want it to be unbiased, meaning an expectation. It gives us what we want, and we want its mean squared error, the measure of the quality or the susceptibility to the sample size, to be less than what we were able to achieve with the single fidelity POD approach, the classic POD approach that we're calling here Curly-J-MC for Monte Carlo. Then once we have this estimator, we're going to compute the multi-fidelity POD basis just the way we normally would with this minimization. All right, so this is what the multi-fidelity POD cost function looks like, and I'm sparing a lot of the details, getting straight to the result, but I think you can see that the structure of this estimator just really reflects what we saw in the scalar case with multi-fidelity Monte Carlo. So it's our multi-fidelity estimator of the POD cost function. This first term here, 1 over M0, the sum of the errors. So again, this is what we would have in the single fidelity case. If you're taking M0 samples of a high fidelity model and just doing POD, this is what you would have. Then here we see the control variate terms. Again, it's a sum from L is 1 to capital L. So this is a sum over all of our cheaper surrogate models. Here are the control variate coefficients. And then here are those two sums, one using model L with ML samples, one using model L with ML minus 1 samples, taking the difference so that on average you add nothing. But again, what we're going to see is that this is going to reduce the variance. And just like in the multi-fidelity Monte Carlo case, the total sampling cost is going to be the sum of the cost of each level times the number of samples that we use it. All right, so you can, or your amazing postdoc, Nicole, can figure out the mean squared error of all of this. And again, on this slide, I think you can just see the reflection of what we had in the scalar case. So again, we see the 1 over M, the sigma squared over M. This is the classic single fidelity Monte Carlo result. And then you see these control variate terms popping up. What you see now here is the variance of this thing and then the covariance terms between the truth model, the high fidelity model, model zero, and the ELF model. I'll talk in a second about actually being able to get a handle on estimating these things because this is currently something that we're avoiding, and I'll get to that in a second. But again, you can write all of this out. Just like before, you can start to rearrange these terms. You can derive some conditions on when is a low-fidelity model going to be useful, because you can imagine that if you have a low-fidelity model that's quite expensive and it's not well correlated with the high-fidelity model, then you don't want to use it. But if you have a model that's really, really cheap, and on average the correlation is close to 1, then this is a model that you're going to want to put a lot of samples in. So you can rearrange all of this to get some conditions against which you can evaluate models that people might give you to decide whether they buy their way into the estimator. You can also go and derive expressions for the optimal control variate coefficients, and you can see them here mimicking what we saw before. When you use the optimal control variate coefficients, you get this expression for the mean squared error of the multi-fidelity POD cost function, and you can show that if your models satisfy certain conditions, then you are guaranteed to not do worse than what you would do by using just model zero. Okay, how am I doing on time? All right. In the paper, I'm not going to go through them today, in part because they are not really my thing. This is really Nicole's work. And also, I think it's just a bit too detailed, especially for the last talk of the afternoon and 102 degrees in Paris. But in the paper, there are a number of theoretical results, and let me just summarize them. One is that the MFPOD correlation operator, so this is in the discrete, when it's discretized, the equivalent of that N by N, that big matrix, converges in probability to the POD second moment operator. The analysis is done in the continuous space, and you see the rate of convergence coming to be inversely proportional to C total with a constant that you can show is independent of the number of samples. As a consequence, you can derive an upper bound for the mean squared error of the summed eigenvalues and how they approximate the truth eigenvalues of POD. And I'm going to go through this when I go through the numerical results, but I want you to remember that the POD eigenvalues, or the singular values, are really important because they are telling you how much each POD basis vector is representing of your snapshot, right? So the eigenvalues and whether you can get them right are important because these are telling you, are you picking up the right directions in your parameter space to get this optimal basis? If you don't truncate in the middle of a pair of POD modes with identical eigenvalues, which you should not do, so on that condition that lambda r is strictly greater than lambda r plus 1, of course these are the optimal ones, so you might not know this, you can then also get an upper bound for the mean squared error of the projection error, again relative to the truth POD eigenfunctions. And I think it is not a practically useful result because as you're going to see, the whole idea of this approach is that this is what you should do when you have a low budget. But in the limit, as you have an infinitely large budget, we can show that we're recovering the truth POD subspace. And so maybe if you're a mathematician, this makes you feel more comfortable about what's going on. Okay, I did want to show you the algorithm. And that there's a version of this paper up on archive. So I wanted to show it to you to first of all show you just how simple the approach is to implement, but also to point out a couple of issues that you can run into and also a couple places where we don't yet, I think, have a good answer for what to do. So the first is, this might be a little small, but if you see here the input, so this question of sample sizes, I showed the expression for the optimal control variate weights and for the optimal sample sizes, but those expressions also depend on your ability to be able to estimate those variance and covariance terms that show up. I mentioned in the multifidelity Monte Carlo theory, we use pilot samples to get estimates of those quantities, and we actually showed in the original paper that the performance of the multifidelity Monte Carlo is not that sensitive to getting those estimates wrong. As long as you get a roughly good estimate of the rho, you do okay, and it's, I mean, maybe you're not optimal. In this case, we find it's a little more sensitive. We've actually found that setting the control variate coefficients to be 1, which is, by the way, what the multi-level Monte Carlo people use. They use alpha equal 1, and then adapting them during the algorithm is, as you are accumulating more samples, is actually the most effective approach. For the sample sizes, what we're doing right now is just fixing the budget. And what I'm going to show you in the numerical results, we're going to see half the budget allocated to the high fidelity model and the other half allocated to the low fidelity model. The theory also that Nicole has worked out for convergence requires the fixed ratio of low and high fidelity samples. You're going to see in the results that we're already getting quite significant speed ups, even with this somewhat dumb strategy for the M0s, which tells me that if you could truly optimize the sample sizes, I think we could do perhaps quite a bit better. But how to do that in a way that's numerically robust? If you know the answer, of course you can get it, but to do it in a way that's numerically robust is still a little bit of an open question. So in what I'm going to show you, we are fixing the sample sizes. We're going to set alpha equal 1 coming in, and then there's an adaptation strategy for that. But here's the algorithm. So start by drawing your M1. And by the way, this is just shown for 2 levels. It's very straightforward to extend it to L levels, but just for ease of understanding, 2 levels, 0 and 1. So draw M1 samples of theta. That's the most you're going to need. You're going to run the first M0 of them through the high fidelity model, U0. You're going to stick those in the snapshot matrix that we call S0. You're going to run those first M0 also through the low fidelity model. You're going to stick those in the snapshot matrix S1. Then the rest of them from M0 plus 1 up to M1, the rest of them, and that's going to be a lot more, you're going to run those through the low fidelity model, but not the high fidelity model, just the low fidelity model, and you're going to put that in what we're calling their S+. Then we're going to form that multi-fidelity matrix. It's the multi-fidelity covariance correlation matrix. It's called here CMF. Here's what it looks like. It's just the 1 over M. It's the SS transpose. Now, of course, SS transpose is of big dimension, n by n, so you don't actually want to form it. What you're really after, because we're after the eigenvectors of this operator or of this matrix, all we need is its matrix action on a vector V. So here, we're not actually forming SS transpose, but if you want to think about it simply, it's the SS transpose plus the control variate weighted terms that use the S1 and the S plus. Now, there's something you've got to watch out for, which is the way we've constructed the multi-fidelity, the CMF, is not guaranteed to be positive definite. So you're not guaranteed to get strictly positive eigenvalues out of that. There are ways, and there's work in the literature on multi-fidelity covariance matrix estimation where you can use a much more complicated algorithm to guarantee positive definiteness. What we have found is that simply doing the simplest thing, doing this, and then looking for any negative eigenvalues and cleaning them out and making them positive works extremely well and extremely robustly. So the rest of the algorithm down here is just a little bit of a cleanup for if your multi-fidelity CMF generates any negative eigenvalues, you need to take care of them because otherwise you're not going to have a good result. That is it. I also want to note that after posting the paper on archive, Benjamin proposed a way to do this where you could work with S transpose S instead of SS transpose, which I think would be computationally advantageous depending maybe on how many snapshots you take of the low-fidelity model. So back to those original slides, whether you like to think of POD as SVD, eigenvectors of SS transpose, or linear combinations of the snapshots through S transpose S, all of those have probably multi-fidelity versions, and depending on the relative dimensions you're working with, you could use either one. Okay, let's spend a little bit of time going through the results, because I think the results give some really nice insight as to what's going on and what's possible. So the first one is a simple 1D advection diffusion problem. Actually, it's a problem that's got an analytic solution. So what I'm going to show you, so what are we looking at here? So we've got a high fidelity finite element discretization that has just over 4,000 degrees of freedom, low fidelity, 33 degrees of freedom. So in this case, it's a coarse mesh approximation. There's a ratio of about 1 to 30 of the computational costs. We're going to compute a reference POD basis that we'd call the truth by just sampling theta. In this case, theta is a scalar, just sampling it to death. So generating 100,000 snapshots and computing the POD basis. So let's take a budget of five high fidelity solves. You get five snapshots. You've got to sample this uncertain parameter theta. So you sample, you generate five snapshots, you compute the POD basis. What we're looking at here are the POD eigenvalues. Of course, the POD, which is the orangish one, can only compute five non-zero eigenvalues. And depending on which luck of the draw, which five samples you happen to take, the eigenvalue spectrum would look different. So what you're looking at here with the box and whisker plot is repeating that experiment of five snapshots many times, and you see the spread that you get from taking only five snapshots. And then, of course, eigenvalues 6 through n are 0. With the multi-fidelity method, we're going to give it the same budget of 5. It's going to get two high-fidelity solves, and then the rest should be going to low-fidelity. The way that Nicole did the rounding, she actually has only used 4. If you add up these, this is actually only a budget of 4. So there's actually one high fidelity remainder. That's fine. We can set that aside. It's giving an unfair advantage to POD here. But what you see, so first of all, what's striking with the turquoise bars is two high fidelity solves, but you can still compute more than two directions in space because of all these low fidelity solves that you've got in there. You see the smaller variance, you see the variance reduction, there's less spread. You still should ask the question, well, just because the eigenvalues look like this, are they the right eigenvalues? There's a little bit of theory around that that I didn't discuss that's in the paper. Before we go to the next slide, we could double the budget. So here, 10 high fidelity solves, which is 5 high fidelity and 620 low fidelity. And again, with POD, at most you could get 10 non-zero eigenvalues. We actually find that by 8, 9, and 10, they're mostly going to numerical zero. And then you see the multi-fidelity. Okay, so we can get more modes. Are they the right modes? So what we're looking at here on this slide is the captured energy. So now this is the cumulative sum of the modes, and this is a measure of that projection error. The horizontal lines shown here, these are the reference results. So this is the best you can do. In this measure, this is the optimal basis. And what we should be asking is, are we getting closer to optimal? Are we finding a better basis? So again, we see POD in this burnt orange color. It only gets 5. You see the big spread. You see that sometimes you get lucky and you actually get pretty close to optimal. Sometimes you are actually very far from optimal. The multi-fidelity method consistently has lower variance, less spread, and is consistently getting closer to optimal here and is continuing to find useful directions in parameter space when you're going beyond the number of high-fidelity samples that you had with the same budget. Again, this says 5. This is really with a budget of 4, and this is a budget of 5. So this one would do even better if we really used all the budget. Here it is 10 and 10. And here I think you can really see the variance reduction. Now you should ask the question, well, maybe your high fidelity model was just wasteful. Maybe you should just use the low fidelity model to compute the POD basis. That is the lighter orange. You can't see any lighter orange boxes on the box and whisker because for the same budget, you can afford so many low fidelity solves that there's basically no spread in the estimators with all these repeats. But what you can see, if you see them here flattening out, this is the bias now of the low fidelity model. The low fidelity model has an error, and you can sample it infinitely, and you will never do better than the error in your low fidelity model. So this is where you see the multi-fidelity giving you the best of both worlds, the cheapness of the low fidelity model, but that multi-fidelity formulation that gives you the unbiased estimator, which is what lets you overcome the error in the low fidelity model. I won't spend time going over this, but we look at the performance of the methods as a function of budget. And really the message here is you're going to win with the multi-fidelity strategy when your budget is very limited. As the budget gets bigger, you don't need the multi-fidelity strategy because you can compute enough high-fidelity snapshots. We've got some unexplained behavior going on for high budgets that I think is a result of not using optimal sample allocations, because when I see POD beating the multi-fidelity like this, it tells me that an optimal strategy would have been just to put all your samples into the high-fidelity code. So I think this behavior is a consequence of not having the optimal samples. All right, really quickly, let me just show you this applied to back to the ice sheets. Rather than Greenland, this is going to be Pine Island Glacier, which is a glacier in Antarctica. This is a nice example because, as I mentioned, the climate community have all these different models that they use. So in this example, it's going to be a simplified physics model. The highest fidelity is something that they call the higher order model. It basically is the model, it models the strain rates of the velocity fields of the ice sheets, a highly nonlinear model. The uncertain parameter is this Bessel friction field, beta. So this friction field, it lives on the spatial domain. The spatial domain you see here for Pine Island Glacier has about 10,000 degrees of freedom. For the higher order model, it's a 3D model. There are 10 vertical layers where the grid is just extruded. So there's 103,000 degrees of freedom. And the high order model, the parameter has dimension of the spatial discretization. So it has dimension of 10,000. The low fidelity model is what they call the shallow shelf approximation, where instead of modeling the velocity everywhere, they model the depth average velocity components. So it's a physical approximation, and because you're now averaging over the height of the ice sheet, the dimension of this this SSA, the shallow shelf approximation model, is now just 10,000 degrees of freedom. It depends a little bit on the case. On average, it's about 100x speed up, going low fidelity over high fidelity. The worst case is 72. So to give POD every possible chance, we're going to use the worst case, which is just a 72 factor speed up. Again, you can start off by looking at the POD eigenvalues you compute. So here's POD versus reference. Reference used 10,000 snapshots. Here's multi-fidelity POD versus reference. Again, you see the spread from all these different runs, but what's really remarkable here, there's only two high fidelity solves of the higher order model and 216 low fidelity. And yeah, sometimes you don't do great, but look how well you are doing in getting the decay. Again, you should ask the question, you are getting the eigenvalues, but are you getting the right subspace? So same plots as we were looking at before. Here are the references. That's the best we can do. Here are the POD. Here with a budget of 5, here with a budget of 10. Even, you know, you just can't get these higher order modes. And what you see is just the same story as before, which is the multi-fidelity POD reduces the variance, so gets you tighter estimates on those low order modes and lets you keep computing higher order modes that are not optimal but are fairly close to it as you go out. You can also look at the mode plots, and you can really see the multi-fidelity and how it's able to generate better modes. So just to close there, again, we're really trying to address the expense of generating training data. I think if any of us want to have our techniques used in the real world, this is an issue that we're going to have to face sooner or later. Even these early results with suboptimal choices for the sample allocations and the control variate coefficients are giving us orders of magnitude computational speedups. What I've shown you here is the parametric sampling case, which is very nice because there's a direct analogy to the Monte Carlo approach. I think the real gains to be seen here are in the time-dependent simulations where you can't afford to run a fine-grid high-fidelity model out over a long time horizon. It's a little bit trickier to think about the theory in that case, but that's something that we are working on now. And the paper is up on archive. If you have energy for questions now, I'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, also happy to stay around afterwards. But again, thank you, and thank you to Yvonne for hosting this wonderful workshop.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.